Hello, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's second discussion in the series, Today's Topics and Health Disparities. I'm Kara James, your moderator for today, and the Foundation's Senior Policy Analyst on Race, Ethnicity, and Healthcare. Today's Topics and Health Disparities is a series of conversations that address issues relating to health and healthcare disparities in the U.S. The goal is to raise the level of understanding of these disparities. Today's topic in disparities, child health, why are expansions in coverage important, comes at a time when Congress is considering SCHIP reauthorization and when several states have proposed or are considering legislation for universal health coverage. It also comes after a recent New York Times article reported that infant mortality rates in several southern states have risen, and the mortality rate for African American infants in Mississippi is more than twice that of whites. Our conversation today will cover some of the many disparities in children's health and health care. We will address the role of health coverage in health disparities, the differences in health coverage among children, and the implications of current expansion proposals in reducing racial and ethnic health disparities. We welcome your questions, so feel free to email us at todaystopics@kaisernetwork.org. Our panel today includes three distinguished guests whose bios are available on our website. In our studio, we have Dr. Gail Christopher, Vice President and Director of the Health Policy Institute at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, and Cindy Mann, Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University. And joining us by telephone is Richard Figueroa, Health Advisor to California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Thank you all for joining us. Dr. Christopher, I'd like to start with you. Can you give us an overview of some of the disparities in children's health and healthcare?
I certainly can, Cara, and thank you so much for including me in this very important discussion. By almost any measure, if we look at healthcare, quality, or health status, children of color, African Americans and Latino, and to a large measure immigrant children with low-income families, all fare much worse in terms of health outcomes. Disparities are real, and they've been persistent for many decades. If we start with, as you mentioned, infant mortality rates in the African American community have been twice as high as the white community for a very long time. What is most alarming right now is that they're actually going up and not down. And access to care is an important factor there. But if we look at the myriad challenges that children face, from obesity to asthma to a very debilitating challenge, which is lead burden and lead poisoning, we still see excess occurrences of these challenges in children of color, particularly African American and Latino children. Poverty is a major factor. If we consider all the variables, low socioeconomic status and poverty puts these children at a much greater risk. And then you couple that with limited access to care. Many of the children who could be enrolled in public programs like Medicaid are not. So we find that in African American children, they more frequently do not have a source of primary care. They don't have a source of regular treatment. And they face a greater risk for these conditions and a greater incidence of many of these conditions, even childhood obesity, which leads to early onset adult diabetes, is more common among African American and Latino and Native American children as well. So these disparities are real, and they've been persistent for a very long time.
Thank you. Cindy, can you tell us a little bit about the coverage of children and what the picture looks like there, particularly for minority children?
Sure. Coverage is a very important link, of course, to access to care and to some of the services that Gail just talked about that are so critical for children's ability to grow and to develop to their full potential. In the world of health coverage, we see the same kinds of disparities. If we focus in on the coverage world, and I think Gail talked about more generally, we see children of color represent about 42% of all children, and yet they constitute about 62% of the uninsured children. The disparity in particular is in health coverage is particularly strong with respect to Hispanic Latino children. The uninsured rate among Hispanic children is quite high, has persistently been high, Although it ranks high for African American children and for Native American children and for Asian children relative to what the rate is for white children. So we see it with all groups, and it is particularly extreme with respect to Hispanic and Latino kids. We have seen that, you know, it's always hard to figure out chicken and the egg. Mm-hmm. We've talked about issues around poverty. Certainly, by and large, we see children who are lower income, children who are poor, have a higher incidence of being uninsured. So you see exactly those same connections as you look at the coverage rates, as you see more broadly in terms of looking at health status and other problems. And if you think about how most people in America get their health insurance, they mostly get it through their jobs. So when we look at coverage disparities, first it's important to look at what goes on in the private sector. So children of color, their parents are less likely because of their incomes, because of the kinds of jobs they have, to have access to employer-based coverage. They are working at the same rates, sometimes higher rates, sometimes mm-hmm. three jobs. Mm-hmm. But they are their jobs in particular, either the low-wage jobs, the seasonal jobs, the jobs in the service sector, are the jobs that are least likely to provide an affordable option of health insurance coverage. Public coverage, therefore, in the form of both Medicaid and the state children's health insurance program for children, then become a very important tool for trying to address the disparities. And what we've had over the last 10 years is really a remarkable decline in the uninsured rate for children generally. Because of the enactment of the state children's health insurance program and because of really some extraordinary new efforts that many states have taken to simplify their programs, to really focus on enrollment, not just eligibility. And we have seen those gains in children gaining coverage across all groups of children, yet the disparities remain. We have been narrowing those disparities somewhat, but the disparities remain.
Mm-hmm. So before I turn to Richard Kill, can you talk to us a little bit about what are some of those other factors besides health insurance coverage that play into these disparities, if we still see the disparities after mm-hmm. we have some gains in access?
It's a complex picture, but certainly income and socioeconomic status, as Cindy indicated, are critical. They seem to be the determining factor. And if we can do more to improve conditions within communities so that families have a living wage and they also have access to providers, part of the problem is also cultural difference and cultural competency. Surveys have indicated that families of color have difficulty interacting with healthcare professionals of a different race sometimes. There are language barriers, there are communication barriers. And that may affect compliance and behavior issues associated with the management of chronic diseases. Also, with the absence of access to quality care, you end up having more emergency room care, and the emergency room care often lacks the appropriate follow-up and, again, compliance with recommendations. We see this in the most serious and pervasive illness among children, which is asthma. Mm-hmm. We have a disproportionate number of emergency visits among children of color, particularly African American children, twice as high and higher in many areas. So we have socioeconomic status. We have generational discrimination that's a reality within our culture, which leads to a lack of proper integration of the healthcare workforce. We don't have enough diversity in the healthcare workforce. We have the percentages are much too low in terms of African American and Latino and Native Americans in the healthcare workforce as physicians, as dentists. Oral health is another disparity. We have 2 to 3 times the number of untreated dental caries, again, among children of color. And these factors, they affect school attendance, you know, they affect learning ability, they affect developmental progress. We can delay a lot of decisions in this country. We can wait for many policy decisions, but children can't wait. This is the critical time in their lives. This is when their brains are developing, when they are meeting certain developmental milestones. And if they don't have good health during that critical period, we will pay for that in the long run because they'll be more susceptible to chronic disease and illness and poor social outcomes as they grow into adulthood. So we need to take a community, a place-based, I think, focus and address the conditions that provide for the well-being of families and the proper functioning of families. Income is a critical factor. Exposure to environmental toxins. We know that there are disproportionate numbers of waste dumps and that sort of thing in and around minority communities. And this has an effect at the prenatal level. It has an effect in the early infancy, and it has an effect throughout the lifespan. Enforcing our policies in terms of lead control and even lead screenings. We find that GAO did a study to assess how many children who were on Medicaid were actually meeting the requirement for lead screening. And their study indicated that 80% of those children are not getting the lead screening at the appropriate age levels. So lead poisoning is a tremendous problem. It affects intellectual capacity. It affects, you know, the development and the school outcomes, and we're just not dealing with it aggressively enough. So in addition to access to care and to coverage, we have to take a community-based, I think, focus, and we have to improve those conditions within communities, socioeconomic, environment, and of course the greatest predictor for problematic health outcomes, both in children and in adults, is the education level of the family. And education becomes a critical social determinant as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, if Carrie, if I could just jump in, I just want to focus a minute just on the relationship of coverage to access to care and to quality of care, because I think that it's important to, at least in the context of thinking about what state coverage efforts are about and what could potentially happen as Congress considers the reauthorization of the state children's health insurance program, so at least to isolate some of the value of coverage. It is certainly not the panacea, but it really has, looking at access to care and quality care, it is necessary but not sufficient. It seems to be the biggest, the largest single indicator of whether a child will get access to care, will get a usual place of care, and then get higher quality care. So again, the disparities can continue. There are lots of other factors, of course, that will affect the health of a child over his or her lifetime. But we shouldn't underestimate the real importance that coverage can provide and think about how to address our coverage policies so that they are really focused on some of these disparity issues and they can get to the kids who need them most, because it really has a big payoff in terms of access to care and quality care.
Okay. Let's talk to Richard here for a second. Richard, you're in California and you guys are doing some efforts there at outreach and exposure to expansion of coverage for children. Can you talk to us a little bit about what's going on there?
I certainly can. And again, thank you for inviting me on this webcast today. I'm kind of following up on what a couple of the previous speakers indicated. You know, we had some California-specific data come out of the journal Pediatrics in 2006 that basically kind of helped buttress what the earlier speakers indicated in terms of compared with folks that currently have insurance, uninsured but eligible children for like Medicaid, SCHIP, or our county health initiatives, experienced significantly poor access to primary care, and for those with more risk factors had poor health statements. So those folks that were uninsured but actually eligible but yet not enrolled had a much more difficult issue, both in terms of accessing physicians as well as their actual health care needs. And in California, the large majority of our students represent underrepresented groups or children of color. So basically everything that we do disproportionately affects children of color, given that's, you know, the large percentage of folks that we have here. As noted earlier, however, even among California children, ethnic minorities are disproportionately affected by the lack of insurance. And so what we've been doing here through both our Medicaid and our SCHIP programs, I'm kind of tick off a number of things here that we've been doing to try to increase our efforts, and then kind of move right into what we plan to do in the future. We've made application linkages through our school lunch programs, through our WIC, Women and Children's Program, through food stamps. We've done things like presumptive eligibility and continuous eligibility. We're doing pilots on self-certification of income. We've tried to bring electronic or information-based technologies to bear in terms of what we call Healthy App or 1E App, which is a county application of a web-based enrollment system. We've done single point of entry, where basically it's a combined SCHIP, Medicaid, enrollment process. We've done something called the CHCP Gateway. Basically, if children come in for their CHCP periodicity treatments, that we give them a certain period of time that's sort of automatic Medicaid, hoping to eventually get them fully enrolled through the process. We spend $40 million a year in county-based outreach grants, which they then forward to lots of community-based organizations, really focused on those hard-to-reach populations, particularly immigrant populations that are new to this country and may not be familiar with our healthcare system, or may otherwise be daunted or afraid of applying for medical care. We've done things in terms of trying to establish bridges between our SCHIP and our Medicaid program. So if your income goes up or your incomes go down, we do have a separate SCHIP program here, separate from our Medicaid program. So as your income go up or down, there's a bridge between those two, giving people time to apply for the appropriate level of care. Despite all that, and despite the fact that our Medicaid program in terms of enrollment is about double the size of the closest state, despite the fact that our SCHIP program is double the size of the closest state, we still have about 750,000 children that lack insurance in California, again, heavily disproportionately Latino and representing underrepresented groups. So what we have done here as part of the governor's overall health care reform plan that was outlined in January, kind of starting with an individual mandate. We're basically, telling every parent, by law, you must enroll your child in some sort of health insurance program, whether it be, public or private insurance, given that, in some cases in society, whether it be child car seats or compulsory education, something's important enough that you need to make it compulsory. And this particular case, as relates to kids, it would be a parental responsibility to seek and maintain coverage for their child. When you do something like that, though, of course, you have to make subsidies available, particularly for those that are lower income, that would not otherwise have the means to support that expenditure. So we already have our SCHIP program goes to 250%. We're seeking to raise it to 300% of the federal poverty level, which is about $60,000 for a family of four. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, it's all children. So if you're at or below 300%, you'd be eligible either for our Medicaid program or our Healthy Families, which is our SCHIP program here, regardless of documentation status. And that's one of these difficult issues in societies, one of these fault lines in societies in terms of how you deal with the undocumented. But the governor believes, for some of the reasons that were mentioned earlier, you want to make sure that children, number one, are able to succeed well in school. There's significant investments that states are making in public education in this country. And number one, you want to make sure the child's actually going to be, in the seat to begin mm-hmm. with, that they're not absent due to treatable medical conditions. And number two, if they are in the seat, that they're able to fully participate in classroom activities. So you have to deal with things like asthma and others that would otherwise interrupt their ability to concentrate appropriately. So we are taking out some of those very, very difficult issues, including the coverage for undocumented children. The governor believes it's both a moral and an ethical issue that we have to deal with. We can't sweep these issues, under the rug. And through this combination of the individual mandate, by expanding coverage to folks that are below 300%, regardless of their documentation status, we think we can cover about two-thirds of those uninsured kids through public programs, either it be Medicaid or SCHIP, and then that additional one-third would be kind of above our subsidy levels. And at that point, parents who have the responsibility to seek and maintain coverage for their children would be purchasing that in the private market or seeking employer-sponsored coverage for those children.
I have a question. I just wondered, in a compulsory situation or a mandate, one implies that there's some costs or penalties associated with noncompliance. Could you elaborate on the consequences of failure to enroll?
Yeah, we've approached this more as no wrong door, about certainly for the public programs, trying to make sure that in every, making enrollment devices, lack of a better term, available at all the major points of contact for a child with the system, whether it be, school-based environment, CBO, hospital, physician's office, et cetera. Your question is a good one, because we are currently trying to figure out, what is the most efficient way of enforcing the individual mandate, and there's certainly lots of questions out there. We're kind of watching very closely what Massachusetts is doing in this regard. But I think we focus this more on an opportunity to get people enrolled in appropriate programs versus, you know, some kind of heavy-handed government at the back end. So we're going to do, you know, try to make it as easy as we can through no wrong door to get children and adults into public sponsorship, but at the same time make them aware they do have this responsibility and are kind of looking at different options to take appropriate action kind of at the back end, hoping we don't have to really go there for the vast majority of people.
Okay. Before I turn back to Cindy, Richard, can you tell us a little bit about some of the specific targeted efforts you may have towards particular minority groups and how some of these efforts have worked better for one group, maybe for another?
A lot of this is kind of happening at the county level, and they've identified specific things. You know, we have a very robust, luckily, and I would certainly encourage other states to do this if they have the fiscal wherewithal, we have a very, very robust database to what they call the California Health Interview Survey. It's a large database. It's kind of like our own version of the CPS, but just for healthcare, where counties are able to kind of look at very localized geographic areas and say, hey, we have a much higher percentage of uninsured kids here versus uninsured kids here, and then really work with the local CBO groups to identify, you know, methods by reaching them. You need kind of people that are important in the community to kind of be out there in front, you know, in terms of institutions that they trust to kind of get the word out there and tell folks, gee, you know, you really aren't endangering your immigration status if you enroll your U.S. citizen children in this kind of program, et cetera, or there are programs available for you, you know, without regard to documentation status. So a lot of this, we've really relied on giving money to counties who then have identified kind of community leadership opportunities in their local communities to really focus on, you know, you might have, you know, for example, a particular issue in the Korean community where you really have to work on that effort. So you've engaged Korean-based, you know, organizations, or in the Latino community it might be churches or other kind of, you know, civic organizations. So kind of basically any way that local counties have identified people that they can work with to engage them in strategies to enroll those children.
I just wanted to follow up. We partner with the various associations of minority providers, like the National Medical Association. I was wondering if you have any specific strategies for engaging the provider community in this extended outreach effort.
We do partner a lot, for example, with our community clinics in California, and we have a very, very extensive network of community clinics. They have an opportunity beyond just getting information about the programs. They have every, obviously, financial incentive to get folks in. But we also have a very extensive process by which we certify people basically to be application assisters. And physicians' offices, doctors' groups, CBOs, insurance agents, et cetera, can receive a per-enrollee payment, which has been actually pretty effective in getting kind of a wide variety of folks to want to participate in doing outreach for us. We have a very extensive network of community clinics, which is where a lot of the uninsured go in California. And so we've really been trying to partner with them in the process of getting folks in.
Okay. And Cindy, can you tell us, Richard has given us a great example of what California is doing. Can you talk to us a little bit about what is happening in some of the other states around?
Sure. And I wanted to also pick up on the issue, which I know is a somewhat controversial issue around the individual mandate, and point out a couple of things that may not be clear to everybody. One is that in California, while our topic here today is about children, in California, it's important to recognize that the individual mandate that the governor is proposing, regardless of what one thinks about it, that it's in the context of a universal coverage proposal, universal both with respect to children, regardless of immigration status, but also bringing in families, bringing in the adults. And one thinks about mandate responsibilities in a different context, I think, when you're doing a much broader based coverage proposal. In that sense, it's a bit similar to Massachusetts. It's also worth pointing out that in Massachusetts, which has become a little bit known for its individual mandate component, although as Richard said, it hasn't yet been defined exactly what the consequences will be and exactly how it will trigger. The children are not included in the individual mandate in Massachusetts. And that was by decision, not by mistake. So I think in thinking about where individual mandates fit in, it's really important to think through what the overall structure and the overall goal is of the approach. And there tends to be more reluctance, certainly in the child-only context, or even in the case of Massachusetts, in the individual context with respect to the kids, to approach it through an individual mandate. Parents, at least our surveys that we've looked at in research, consistently indicate that parents are eager to enroll their children. They're looking for, as Richard talked about, those opportunities. They're looking for ways to get their children into care and see coverage as a key opportunity to doing that because of the affordability issue and the access issue. In terms of what some other states are doing, we've really seen in the last, I would say, 18 months, more activity around expanding and improving children's coverage than we've seen probably since 97, 98, since right after the enactment of the federal CHIP program. I think there's probably a lot of different reasons that have gone into that, but you see that in regions all over the country and a really diverse array of states, not usually what people would think of as the usual suspects in terms of the states taking the lead. We saw Illinois take a step towards universal coverage for children. They did that last year, and they also cover children up to 300% of poverty with a buy-in for families to use the public program insurance package, essentially, as a package to buy into if their incomes were over that level. And Illinois, like Governor Schwarzenegger's proposal, cover children regardless of immigration status. So it truly is an all-children's proposal. And they have found so far that, and I should back up, they coupled the expansion with exactly the same kinds of initiatives that California is thinking about, which is really how do we not just say we're enrolling children or making children eligible. How do we make sure that the children are actually enrolled? And then, of course, the next step is to make sure that they're linked to appropriate care. And so Illinois coupled also its coverage initiative with many of those same kinds of steps. They also have community-based application assisters, which I think they find to be very important, particularly in reaching children of color, children of racial and ethnic minority communities. And they have found that they enrolled about 75% of the kids that they have enrolled since they did the initiative were children who were previously eligible for the program. So one of the lessons we've learned, both from the Illinois experience, we've learned it when states expanded their coverage programs after CHIP, we learned it in some of the counties, actually, that have done universal programs in California on pilot basis, is that the broader the coverage, the clearer the message that all children are eligible, the more we begin to reach those particular children who have always been identified as in the harder to reach communities, that we really begin to have a sense of inclusiveness, a sense of coverage is the norm as opposed to the exception. So I think that makes a big difference. But we're also seeing a lot of states taking some of those simplification steps, not necessarily covering it with expansions, as well as states doing expansions with simplification.
And is there any research that has shown how effective this has been, or is it too soon to sort of really look at and see? And are we seeing enrollment numbers increasing, particularly for minority children?
Cindy may speak to the enrollment numbers, but certainly it's a little early to equate our expansion in coverage opportunities with improvements in health outcomes. The data is still mixed on that. I think the more aggressive we are in creating universal access and including everyone, the more our principles are clear and our values for children are clearly stated, over time we'll be able to collect the data, for one thing, because they'll be in the system, and we'll be able to see better outcomes. But our research and the data that we've looked at suggest that it's a little too soon to equate the expansion opportunities for coverage with clear improvement in health outcomes. But clearly we see in the states like Illinois that there's more enrollment. I think another challenge that we face, and I'm particularly concerned with Illinois because we're working there with them at the Joint Center, what we have to do is also not dismantle the public health infrastructure while we're increasing all these opportunities for enrollment, when we see public hospitals closing and we see a lack of funding for community-based health centers and providers, then we are creating a mess. You know, we'll have more people who need coverage and who have coverage and who need services and have higher expectations for services, and on the other side, we might be cutting the facilities that would be able to provide those services. So we do have to have a comprehensive understanding of the need for not only the opportunities to have care, but who's going to provide the care and where, in terms of the quality of the facilities, where is that care going to be made available?
I think that's absolutely correct. And we see it in, you know, areas across the country, and certainly I think during this fiscal pressures that states were feeling in the early 2000s, 2001, 2002, one of the first areas that they cut back on were provider payment rates and some of their public programs. That has created some access problems. There's basic infrastructure problems. I think a very, very important issue that often gets too little attention is language barriers both with respect to the process of enrolling into coverage for which you're eligible, but language barriers also at the point of care, and it really has a very strong correlation for families for whom English is not their primary language, not having a usual place of care. They may seek out the hospital emergency room or the health center or the clinic, which may or may not, depending upon how it's set up, give them continuity of coverage because they will more likely to find translation services available to them.
This is Richard. One thing I just kind of wanted to add, and it kind of touches on Medicaid reimbursement. As part of our, you know, California has always been very, very broad on eligibility, but, you know, pretty miserly in some way or parsimonious on the reimbursement side. And as part of our overall package, understand that we will be adding more children to our Medicaid system and more adults to our Medicaid system. We're seeking, you know, about a $4 billion rate increase for primarily for physician and hospital-based services to try to increase access at the same time. Because I think, you know, I agree with the earlier speaker about it. It's one thing to give people coverage, but coverage by itself may not mean as much unless you actually have access to, you know, real access to that coverage. The other thing we've kind of done here that's kind of kicking in right now is a number of years ago, Governor signed a bill to expand cultural and linguistic standards, and the standards that we'd apply both to health plans to apply to their insured or to their physician and hospital population in terms of increasing access to appropriate cultural and linguistic services. So we are trying to do things kind of on several fronts, understanding that we do have a very diverse community here, that we are trying to increase the number of people that are insured. And I would add that we used to have over 1 million uninsured kids in California, so we've lowered that by, you know, about 20% so far, at the same time that our population out here continues to grow pretty rapidly, at the same time that employer-sponsored coverage is getting tighter. So there's certainly some things kind of working against us, but despite that, for the variety of, you know, because of the variety of things we are trying to do, we are making progress in terms of the overall, you know, lowering the overall rate of insurance for children and the overall number as well.
And I wanted to, if I can jump in and underscore that point and go back a little bit to the access and health status issue. Sometimes I think the issues of uninsurance generally, and particularly the issues of persistent poverty and disparities for racial and ethnic minority children seem just so overwhelming and so difficult and so much a factor of America in terms of having plagued our system for quite some time that it's easy to be feeling like solutions aren't at hand. And I think many of the things that Gail identified in terms of some of the community-based solutions, we've really see some good examples of it materializing and producing. And in the coverage area, we have, as California's data has shown and as the national data have shown, we have, while the nation was swimming upstream, meaning while costs were going up and more employer-based coverage was becoming less available both to kids and to their parents, we have seen the rate of coverage among children and among racial minority children increase. So we have we can see that there is, if we apply ourselves in a very determined way, that we can make a difference and we can potentially get to that finish line. And so I think it's really important to keep sight of progress that has been made so that we can build on a strong track record and go to where we need to go. In terms of the access to care and health status, I think it's absolutely right. It's very difficult to relate coverage to health status. There's just so many determinants of health status that are hard to control for, to identify what the role particularly is of coverage. That having been said, I don't really know anyone who declines, very many people anyway, who declines coverage and doesn't think it's important. What we do see, though, very consistently is that health coverage, either private coverage through employer-based system or other private coverage or public coverage, does equate to access to care. It does. And there are some differences in terms of racial and ethnic minority kids' access to care, but that phenomenon of coverage equating to access to care carries over for all groups. Beyond that, obviously, we know there are some specific issues, some of the language issues, some quality issues, but it really does make a difference in access to care. So to the extent that we all believe that if you get some medical care, it may have a positive impact on our health status, then I think the assumption's there, but we don't always have the data on the health status, but we certainly have it in the access. And we're beginning to get some data on, you know, kids being able to go to school more days when they have health coverage, right? And so you can begin to understand the implications on coverage to those areas.
And I think it's important to focus in on some subgroups that are particularly vulnerable. If we look, for instance, at public housing communities, the outcomes for the children there, the disparities, are just almost unbelievable in terms of asthma and lead exposure to lead and learning disabilities. And it's important to, I think, take a life course view of this. If we start with the low birth weight and the infant mortality problems, and we follow that child and they don't get the proper care, then we end up with exposure to other challenges and learning disabilities. And then by the time they become juveniles, we see them in the juvenile justice system, where access to care is even more of a challenge, you know, because if they are inmates in the juvenile justice system, they don't get access to the public funds to Medicaid, and their entry and reentry, et cetera, is a challenge. So I think this particular conversation is so important, partially because many of our viewers in the general public, they aren't aware of the health disparities. They don't realize the double-digit differences in terms of minority children and white children, the exponential growth of childhood obesity, and the disproportionate burden among minority children. I'm sure the New York Times article was a surprise to many. We might have thought we had infant mortality, you know, handled in this country, but it has been a persistent problem. So it's important to, A, know that the disparities exist, but also to understand how it affects our broader culture and our broader society. And if we don't take care of children and provide them with the basic primary medical care, you know, they should have a medical home. They shouldn't be rushed to the emergency room at the last minute in the middle of some sort of attack, an asthma attack, and then that family burdened with the cost of paying for that. Even if they don't pay for it, they won't have credit anymore because they will have a bill for thousands of dollars that they didn't pay. So the importance of these issues, I think, cannot be overemphasized. Our children, to coin a phrase, are definitely, or to quote a phrase, are definitely the future. And their needs are really acute now. So we have these disparities. We need to pay attention to them. And if we don't address them in the early childhood years, we're going to see them in the juvenile years, in the young adult years, and particularly in the early adult years. I'm excited that we are accepting the idea of universal coverage. And the states are clearly the laboratory for that. And that's a good thing. How we do that and how we bring about enforcement, if you will, of the mandates, I think that does need to be clarified in some way. And also we need to examine the quality of the care that's going to be available in light of universal access. And there are great disparities in quality. Some of it relates to the healthcare workforce diversity challenge. Other aspects like infrastructure, like the availability of laboratories. If we take the lead burden or the lead poisoning issue, when we dig a little deeper and we ask why, if Medicaid mandates that these children are screened, and they're not being screened, what are the barriers to that? And that is because in some cases the laboratory facilities aren't available. The pediatricians, their caseload is too great to do these screenings. I mean, there are other factors when we dig a little deeper that speak to the quality of the care that our children will have access to and their families will have access to. But these are very important issues. We need to continue to talk about them and to research them. And I agree, we need to look at our successes, and there are some examples of success, and actually believe that in the long run we can provide a medical home and we can provide coverage and insurance for all of our nation's children, and that race will no longer be the dividing line in terms of the quality of care that they receive.
Kara?
Yes.
I know you want to get to questions, but can I want to jump in here real quick?
Sure.
I think that you know, consistent with what the other panelists have been talking about, it is going to take also some broader strategies, kind of moving from the 10,000 foot to the 30,000 foot view in terms of looking at what other kind of strategies can we bring to help deal with some of these larger population issues. For example, looking at, can we do some kind of broad-based strategies to educate the community, both ethnic minority and the general community, about the problems about childhood obesity, and what kind of changes can we make in our society to provide, you know, more availability of fresh fruits and vegetables and things like that to empower people to take some responsibility and communities to take some responsibility over both their short-term and long-term health, because coverage or access by itself will still be treating some of the symptoms, so to speak, without getting to some of these root causes. So one of the things we're trying to do out here is, much like we did with tobacco, is take some very, very broad population health approaches to educating the population about the problems associated with childhood obesity and the actions they can take at the local level and how it really affects everybody. We really didn't get to a lot of the major changes about societal views of smoking and where it was appropriate to smoke or not appropriate to smoke and what the health effects were, until people really realized it wasn't just the smokers themselves who were being harmed by it, but also all the people around them. So it's going to take some larger strategies for states and at the federal level to educate folks about some of these things, so they understand it's not just, oh, gee, this person over here doesn't have health insurance or they're overweight or this, that, and the other, but really how it affects them as well, and that that everyone is part of the solution, not just the individual groups that are specifically affected.
Mm-hmm. All of you have mentioned costs and, you know, what it's going to take. And I just want to talk a little bit about, do we see cost being a prohibitive factor in allowing these programs to expand and to getting to that ultimate goal of having all children covered?
I think certainly cost is always a factor, and sometimes it's a bigger factor than others, but it's always a factor. One of the reasons why we're seeing some more expansions going on at the state level now than we saw 4 years ago is that state revenues are in a better situation than they were 4 years ago. Children are the least costly group to cover, but still they take some costs. So costs are an issue, and it is always hard in the world of government to be able to think in the longer term ways that Gail is urging us to think about, because I think we all intuitively know, and there's certainly evidence to support this, that if you do invest in making sure that children have adequate health care coverage, access to health care, appropriate, good quality care, that it does pay off in the longer run, whether you're looking at your foster care and juvenile justice system, whether you're looking at disabled workers later on, you know, various different factors. It pays off. We've seen studies, certainly in the CHIP context, in the Medicaid context, where, you know, kids who get primary care who have asthma can save costs in preventable hospitalization. So there are some shorter term savings as well. Costs are an issue. I think, though, we are increasingly seeing for the moment, and the question is, can we seize that moment and secure it for all time, that there is a sense that all children should have coverage. You know, when you do polling in the public, it is a there's no second guessing about that question. People think in America today it is a crime. It is outrageous that children don't have coverage. And when they hear some of the coverage statistics and some of the disparity numbers, they're appalled and they want and demand solutions. So I think the public is actually much more there than some of the policymakers, and some of the policymakers are getting there. But we've got to address the cost, and I think we've got to address the relative share of the cost between the federal governments and the states and families and businesses.
And I'd like to pick up on that point. There was a recent article in Health Affairs that projected the costs of Medicaid out at least for another 25 years. And it sort of spoke against conventional wisdom that Medicaid is this 800-pound gorilla that, or Pac-Man, that's eating up state budgets. It actually, the researchers actually suggested that state revenues will be enough to cover the projected growth in Medicaid costs. And I think it's important that we not allow this juxtaposition, if you will, of the federal and the state share in some of these costs. And states, their budgets are definitely experiencing a burden in terms of health care costs. But our domestic priorities, I think, have to be embraced with a sense of our future as a nation. You know, we are going to see at least a 50% minority, and I use that term, you know, guardedly, but people of color will make up at least 50% of the workforce by 2030. If we don't invest in their health and well-being, in our health and well-being, and the well-being of our children, where's the real cost? You know, when we look at the aging, the baby boomer generation being retired, and their Social Security revenues being largely produced by a workforce, you know, we need a diverse, capable workforce, and the seeds of that are planted in childhood through proper education, through proper access to care and quality of health care. So we do have to take that long view, and I think programs like this can help our policymakers to really set priorities that are in the best interest of all of our collective futures.
One other issue is we've talked about access to care being critical, and people have mentioned providers and LEP and culturally competent providers and things like that. Are providers an issue for children? And I'm thinking sort of in some of the more rural areas where getting access to providers could be an issue for them. Are we prepared to give not only just access in terms of coverage, but access in terms of an actual provider?
We're looking definitely at a nursing shortage, and some predict a shortage of physicians. Clearly, in rural areas, you have more medically underserved by virtue of geographic challenges and transportation challenges. We are facing a healthcare workforce challenge. We're facing more people retiring in the public health sector. Again, we have the shortage of nurses, and we could take that and turn that into an opportunity to do more recruiting and more training and more diversifying of our healthcare workforce, and that is part of this discussion. And it needs, we have the Sullivan Alliance as part of our work at the Joint Center, and they are committed to putting policies and practices in place to increase and create a more diverse healthcare workforce. And it's a very important question and a very important issue.
And sort of going back to some of these proposals for universal coverage and care, particularly for children, what's missing? What is not in these proposals that would be critical? You talked about dental access and, I mean, mental health things, and are those pieces?
Oral health is a critical issue. We don't have enough providers there, particularly diverse providers. I think I heard a figure recently that less than 2% of this year's entering class in the dental schools are people of color. And so that's a big challenge. Oral health is a persistent problem. Mental health parity is a critical issue. I'm not sure if that's included in the Massachusetts or the California plan. Cindy may speak to that. But making sure that the mental health treatment is paid for by these public programs, and certainly equally by the private insurance programs, those are critical. But I think what may be missing, and they may not have to be in the programs, but they probably need to be in state and federal budgets, and that is the importance of outreach to communities, the importance of sort of bridging the gap between the institutions that provide care and the families that need care. That's very important in low-income communities. It's very important in diverse communities that you have visiting nurses. you know, that you have, particularly in those early years. We know the data shows us repeatedly that the visiting nurses programs will help in the outcomes and the development of very, very young children. And it is labor intensive and therefore costly. I don't think the costs are prohibitive, but we need to pay attention to that and include that in these, in the design and the implementation of many of the proposals. So community outreach strategies are important. I think they aren't emphasized enough. But I applaud what California is doing. And also working with the associations that represent the diverse providers. I think we need to have stronger partnerships between the Latino and Hispanic Medical Association, the National Medical Association, African-American doctors who understand these communities and understand and can gain the trust of the families and overcome some of the barriers that might affect compliance with the recommendations of the doctors. I think those are important factors. And lastly, health literacy. Richard spoke to that in terms of our need to do population-based education. We need to educate, more importantly, about the individual needs to have a higher level of understanding of their own bodies and the effects of their medications and the issues. Health literacy is a very important factor if we're ever going to control medical costs, really.
I would just emphasize a point Gail made initially in response to the question about the importance of the robustness of the medical, of the benefit package itself, when we're, particularly when we're talking about kids. If you think about their developmental needs, it is, there's a little bit of a sense, and there's certainly some who would advocate, if we're going to cover more broadly, the way to do it in a fiscally sound way is to cover it thinly. And to provide a thin benefit package. And I think that is penny wise and pound foolish. And particularly with respect to children, when you talk about what their health and developmental needs are, most children are healthy. Most won't access any extraordinary services. But when they need it, they truly need it. And so I think we really do have to be mindful of what the package looks like. Medicaid has a standard that basically says, not always implemented properly, but basically says, all medically necessary services for a child must be covered under the Medicaid program. CHIP programs give the state a lot more flexibility, and there's no not nearly as strong a federal standard in terms of the benefits. And states are in different places in terms of how robust their benefit package are. And some of the issues around mental health services in particular, some dental services, sometimes vision and hearing as well. Okay. Certainly some of the rehabilitation services, occupational therapy, speech therapy, a child who's having a hearing problem and needs ongoing speech therapy. Those are issues, again, not every child needs it, but I think we really do have to pay close attention to whether the benefit packages themselves are going to be adequate to meet children's needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in California, we've worked very close, very hard to align our SCHIP program with our Medicaid program, so there aren't that many differences in the benefits. The other thing that we've done is we have a program here called California Children's Services, which is kind of a more specialized network for working with children and families with special health care needs, and we've kind of left that in place irregardless of how high we've gone up in terms of our income eligibility populations for either Medicaid or SCHIP, so we don't lose kind of that specialized tertiary network for children that gets kind of higher reimbursement rates than other kinds of services. So we've been very careful to kind of maintain the existing relationship between the networks of providers to help continue to support, you know, those specialized treatment modalities, at least among that are kind of linked to our California public insurance programs.
And Richard, one of the questions that we did receive is why the California plan doesn't include sort of dentists in its coverage.
Our expansion for children, it's working through existing programs that do include dental, and as much as, you know, in our ESTRA program, we found, as many other states have, that the highest unmet need wasn't really for physician office visits. It was really for just great unmet dental needs where these children were coming in and basically had never seen a dentist and needed mm-hmm. sealants and all kinds of other treatments. As part of our expansion efforts for adults, we've not included dental as a component because of cost issues. We've also not, in terms of our Medi-Cal reimbursement rate increase, It was solely focused on physician and hospital services, because much as it was noted earlier, a lot of this is about also available resources. And in order to fund our Medicaid rate increases and our expansion of coverage, part of our shared benefit, shared responsibility model is an assessment on hospital and physician patient fees, patient revenues. And so we've tied the increases in Medicaid to the sources of the revenue for those increases. We have not done that for dental, mostly because we didn't, you know, we do acknowledge that there are probably access issues in the dental arena, but did not assess dentists as part of the revenue stream. If the dental association or another provider group comes forward and says, yes, please assess us such that we can get a rate increase, then we would certainly, you know, want to look at that. But, you know, so far we've not done that. Neither have the dentists come forth and said they wouldn't want to be assessed to help pay for that increase in reimbursement, you know, either.
And taking it, you know, to looking at some of the other states that haven't quite gotten into the game and some of the barriers and challenges that they're facing, do you have any suggestions or recommendations? When we look at geography, we talked about sort of a local, you know, solutions and things like that, and we have 50% of African Americans living in the South, and, you know, many of the Asian Americans living in the West, and states in the South that may not have been able to do some of these proposals for financial reasons. Do you have any suggestions or recommendations to how we could help them expand their coverage and who should be helping them?
Well, I think there's certainly a role at the federal level to, at a minimum, ensure that there's adequate dollars available for states to use both Medicaid and CHIP have a matching rate structure so that states put in a certain amount of dollars and the federal government matches it. And some of the southern states, the lower states with lower per capita incomes, have a more favorable higher Medicaid higher match rate, both in Medicaid and in CHIP. But there's two issues around the federal reimbursement that I think are important to note without getting too much into the financing. One is the CHIP program has capped financing. There's a limit on how much dollars the federal government has put on the table. And the CHIP program was started 10 years ago. They put a certain amount on the table for the following 10 years. And as you mentioned in your opening, CHIP is up for reauthorization this year. So the big question going forward with CHIP, and it's certainly by far not the only question, but certainly one of the largest questions, is what will be the level of federal commitment to the program? We have state Georgia right now that is thinking of, that is not enrolling children because of a limitation on their federal financing, that is thinking, you know, proposals to roll back eligibility for children, to eliminate dental coverage for children, to be able to deal with the funding shortfall. So we clearly need to have not only adequate funds so that we don't see rollbacks, but hopefully adequate funds so that we can see some of the improvements, whether they're eligibility expansions or really getting deeper into the community so that those eligible but uninsured children get enrolled. So the federal government putting some dollars on the table. And the other issue on the financing is the Medicaid matching rate is less favorable. Those are the lower income children are less favorable to states than the CHIP financing, right? The idea of CHIP was to entice states to expand beyond their Medicaid eligibility levels, and so they enticed states by providing a more favorable matching rate. But states have found that when they do enrollment, and particularly when they're looking at enrollment for the most impoverished communities, that the children they're enrolling are Medicaid eligible, and they have a lower match rate. Some of, I think, the discussion in CHIP reauthorization is, should there be some adjustment in the Medicaid match rate so that there's not a disincentive and so that there's that same incentive, or at least closer to that same incentive, to enroll children who are eligible for Medicaid.
Okay. I'll give you the last word, Gail.
I certainly agree with everything that Cindy has said, and I also think that states are laboratories of innovation. And there should be more sharing, if you will, more best practices communication among the states, because they tend to drive, in many cases, federal policy. But this is an opportune time in our nation's history when we know enough, we've seen it work. The last investment of the last 15 years or so in increasing children's access to care, we know that that has improved the use of care, and we can intuit and know that it will have a tremendous effect on the health status of the children who are most vulnerable. So this is not a time to roll back and to decrease and to disincentivize our states. It's a time to increase the incentives and move us toward universal care, certainly for children.
Thank you. Before we close, I'd like to thank Gail Christopher and Cindy Mann and Richard Figueroa for joining us today. And thanks to all of you for your questions. On our webpage, you'll find resources on today's topic that may be useful to you. Again, I'm Kara James from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you.